Hey everybody, let me remind you one more time about my new blueprint for success. It's a project I've spent months and months working on just to help you jumpstart your comedy career and beat the competition. Whether you want to do stand-up, sketch, improv, acting, writing, producing, directing, radio, social media influencing, or even if you want a career behind the scenes as a manager or agent, Blueprint for Success will give you all the tools you need to take your career to the highest levels. With exclusive interviews, my top 50 commercial-free episodes from industry standard, one-on-one coaching with me, and unprecedented access into my knowledge and experience from over 40 years in this crazy business, I guarantee you that with Blueprint for Success, you'll become the creator you've always dreamed of becoming. No one's asking me to do this. I want to do it because I want to help you become truly undeniable. So just go to barrykatz.com, click on Blueprint for Success, and start your incredible journey today. I truly can't wait to work with you to help you change the trajectory of your comedy career forever.
So we pull up and Frank rolls down the window and he says, "Hi, we're the writers." And the guy said, "What are your names?" And Frank gives him our name. And the guy says, "You're not on the list." And Frank turned around. He looked at me. He said, "We're not on the list." So he said, "What do you suggest we do?" The guy said, "Well, there's a parking lot two blocks down. There's some spaces on the third floor. You park there and then you walk back." Frank says, Oh, great. Thank you very much." And he rolls up the window and he turns around. Now, in front of the Miami Beach Auditorium, there was a circle then with grass and a flagpole in the middle of the circle. And Frank turns around and he decks it. And we back up, bounce over the sidewalk and slam into the flagpole. Frank opens the door and he gets out and he's standing there. He's backlit now because there's lights coming from the Miami, from the marquee. He's backlit. He stands there. He's instantly soaking wet and he says, "See ya." And he walked off into the night and I never saw him again. It was the greatest exit in the history of time. He just went away.
Welcome back to another episode of Industry Standard with me, Barry Katz, my guest, Don Rio. I am so excited. I can't even tell you guys. This is probably going to be one of the most influential and one of the most informative podcasts you will ever see. But I don't want to put any pressure on Don because, you know, I don't want him to lose his temper. So I'm just going to introduce him. This may take longer than the cold open. Guy's got a lot of credits, but hopefully we'll be okay. Don Rio is an American television writer and producer. He has written, created, and produced hundreds of hours of television from the 70s to today. He began as a writer on ABC's Jimmy Durante Presents The Lennon Sisters, for which he wrote five episodes over the first season before writing for NBC's Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In, Can You Say Sock It to Me, where he wrote 50 episodes over 2 years. He would go on to write comedy specials, including the Jackie Gleason special and a Laugh-In special. His television credits include, but are not limited to, The Mary Tyler Moore Show, All in the Family, Private Benjamin, Empty Nest, The Golden Girls, Wizards and Warriors, Double Trouble and Hard Knocks, and many, many, many more, which we will talk about. He's worked with talented comedic actors, creating vehicles for them, including Jay Moore, Rhea Perlman, Lenny Clark, Rodney Carrington, John Larroquette, and Damon Wayans with My Wife and Kids, which went 5 years and 123 episodes. In 1990, he wrote and produced the TV movie Blossom, which spawned the successful NBC TV show of the same name, which we just talked about. Most recently, he's produced the last 2 years of Everybody Hates Chris, the autobiographical TV show about a comedian Chris Rock's childhood, and created the Fox show Brothers, starring NFL Hall of Famer and charismatic man Michael Strahan. Outside of the television world in 2010, he co-wrote an unbelievable semi-fictional autobiography titled Big Man, with and about Clarence Clemons, longtime saxophonist for Bruce Springsteen's E Street Band and one of his best friends. I should say the late Clarence Clemons. The book chronicles the life of Clemons during and beyond the E Street Band, including unbelievable, never-before-told adventures with Bruce and the band. Currently, Don is the executive producer on Two and a Half Men, where he's been there since 2011. Please welcome my guest today, the man, the myth, the legend, the slightly bored, Don Rio.
Well, thank you. That sounds pretty impressive. I didn't realize I'd done all that stuff. How old is this guy?
You don't look it old at all.
Oh, I know. Well, thank you. All of that is partially true. You know, there are stories that go with every one of those credits, every one of the things you're talking about. But even before the first television show I did, which was the Durante Show, I had spent the previous 2.5 years on the road playing straight for a comedian named Slappy White.
Yes, and I want our audience to hear this story because the way I remember it, Don Rio as a teenager was in Woonsocket, Rhode Island?
I was in North Kingstown, Rhode Island, in my father's furniture store, and I heard that you could make money writing jokes. There was a column in the newspaper. A guy named Earl Wilson wrote a column, and he said that there was a writer in New York named Woody Allen who was making $500 a week writing jokes, and I thought that was astounding. How is that possible? I could do that. So I started to try to sell jokes to comics who came through town. First person who bought a joke from me was a woman named Kay Ballard.
Kay Ballard,
yeah,
of course.
Who's still around. And
do you remember the joke she bought?
I don't remember the particular joke, but it was a great relationship. You know, she encouraged me, and she thought I should be an actor and I should be in a play with her. And we had a few adventures. But
when you say adventures...
Well, I visited her in New York. She sponsored me with acting lessons with a guy named Bill Hickey.
But you're a teenager.
I was a teenager.
So your parents just let you go to...
My parents didn't have a whole lot to do with this. I'm not sure how much I told them. You know, I lived in Rhode Island. I would drive up to New York and take a lesson with Bill Hickey and then drive back and go back to the furniture store. It was the beginning of my schizophrenia. But... It was an interesting time. She was about to do a play called A Mother's Kisses that Bruce J. Friedman had written. And she wanted me to play her son. That was how this started. And
really?
Then there was a strike and it never happened. The play got canceled. And I met Slappy and my life changed dramatically.
Now tell our audience how you met Slappy.
Okay. I'm in Rhode Island. I'm watching The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, and Slappy White was on. He was a guest and he was doing a routine called The First Black Vice President, which was he wore a derby hat and he put on sunglasses and smoked a cigar. And it was a question and answer thing. You know, where do you stand on unemployment? At the head of the line. I understand you were the first black athlete at the University of Mississippi. That's right. I was a javelin catcher. So he was very funny. And I thought, wow, this guy is really good. The next morning, that was a Wednesday. On Thursday morning, I pick up the newspaper and he's playing a club in Rhode Island called the New Farm Supper Club.
How far was that away from you?
20 minutes from my house. So I made a reservation and I started writing jokes. So I wrote jokes Thursday, Friday, and during the day on Saturday, I go to the club and he did two shows. And in the first show, he did the first black astronaut. And there's a maitre d' doing the straight lines.
So in other words, he just does... The way Slappy worked, he just did one full routine.
He did a monologue, and then he would come back in whatever this costume was. And the astronaut, he had a jumpsuit and a helmet that he would come out in. And the second one, the black vice president, he would just put on the derby hat. And it was a set-up punchline thing. The first black vice president was 25 questions and answers, 25 setups and punchlines.
And the audience, the demographic of the audience was what?
Well, at that point, there, it was white. It was all white. That was a white supper club. But as you'll see, between the two shows, I go to see him in the dressing room. I knock on the door. It was a dressing room. It was the manager's office. The guy ran the place. And Slappy was sitting behind a desk. And I came in and I introduced myself. And I've got my jokes. And I said, I've written some jokes. And he said, I pay $10 a joke. So I said, oh, that's fine, you know, whatever. And he said, let me see them. So I gave him these, I think I had three sheets of paper. And he read halfway down the first page, and he had reading glasses on. He looked at me over the glasses. He said, can you read? And I thought, oh, shit. What have I misspelled something? What's this? And I said, yeah, you know, I can read pretty well. He said, the reason I ask, he says, I'm using busboys and maitre d's to play straight. And when I do these two routines, and they can't read, they f*** up the timing and it's a mess. I said, yeah, I can read. He said, well, would you like to go on the road with me and play straight? And he said, you can write jokes every day and play straight for me in the act, and I'll give you $150 a week. $300 a week he was going to give me. $300 a week and pay my expenses. My father was giving me $150 at the time to deliver furniture. So it wasn't a difficult choice. So I said, sure. So he said, okay, we open at the Apollo Theater next Friday night with Jackie Wilson. So I said, great. And he gave me his address in White Plains. He said, if you can come up to the house, we can work on, you know, some jokes. You got some good jokes here, and, you know, we'll hang out. So I said, all right.
Now, did you have a car?
I had a car. I think I was 19. So I went home, and the next morning I told my parents I was leaving town with a 52-year-old black man named Slappy. And this was not well received. It was, I got a lot of cautions. But I went, and I went and hung out at his house for a few days. He was married to a singer named Laverne Baker at the time, had big hit records, Tweedledee Dee and a couple of others. Previously, he had been married to Pearl Bailey and Dinah Washington. He was attracted to singers.
I had Dinah Washington's album when I was a kid.
Yeah. Well, I met Laverne the first night I arrived there. She was leaving the next day to go on a tour of the Far East, and Slappy never saw her again. She went off and never came back. That was the end of that marriage. It dissolved somewhere.
Normally, it's the men who go to the Far East who you never see them again.
Yes, right. And he lived next door to a woman named Jackie Mabley, Moms Mabley, and her daughter Bonnie. And they lived in the house immediately next to his house, which was a split-level house in White Plains. And there was a sign on the roof of Mom's house that said, no squares allowed. Big sign. You wouldn't recognize Moms Mabley off stage.
Now, for those of you who don't know, Moms Mabley, one of the greatest female comedians or any comedians of all time. And I used to love her as a... 10-year-old white kid.
Yeah, she was great. She was Whoopi Goldberg recently did a biopic about her, and it's really worth tracking down. She was very, very funny. She worked the Chitlin Circuit, and she had this character that she did. Anyway,
she did a character of an old woman,
very old woman. Yes, the oldest woman in the world. So we worked, Slappy and I worked on the act, and then Friday we went to the Apollo Theater, and I walked out on stage for the first time in my life. Anywhere, and I introduced him as the first black vice president. That was the bill that it was Big Maybell, Slappy and I, and Jackie Wilson. And that was the first time I was ever on any stage anywhere.
Were you nervous?
Yeah, I was nervous.
Were you the only white person on stage?
I was the only white person in 10 blocks. There were no white people around there. I didn't see many white people for the next 2.5 years.
Now, explain how you felt so comfortable, because from what I'm getting from your family, I'm not saying your family might have been racist, but they certainly weren't like 100% the other way.
No, they were in between. I mean, it was a totally different time. You know, the world was in a state of upheaval, and this is the mid 60s. It was pretty crazy. And attitudes were changing. They weren't racist, but they were worried for me. You know, we worked the Apollo Theater when there was a riot in Harlem. And it was a little, you know, it's a funny story. Years later, I was working with George Schlatter and Cher. We were doing the Cher special. And we went to New York together, and Cher was going to do a show at the Apollo with Diana Ross. So we went up to the Apollo Theater and sat with Bobby Schiffman, who ran the theater at that time. He had inherited from his father, and he kept a record of every act that played there. So I said, well, look up the first time we played there, which was October of 67 or 68, I forget. And and see what you wrote down for Slappy White. And he wrote, Slappy White has white boy with him, could be trouble. But there was no trouble. It was great. I mean, we were...
So the first show you killed.
We did very well there. We kind of tailored the act for that audience, for a black audience, and it worked. I had an orange tuxedo, and I walked out, and he was wearing a black tuxedo. He said, that's a nice tuxedo, Mr. Rio. I said, thank you. He said, we used to dress like that. So that was kind of an icebreaker. And after that, we just hit the road.
So there was never any time in a stand-up where he would, you know how like on Def Jam when it started, one of the most favorite things that the African-American comics would do would imitate the white man. Brother.
No, we never did that. We did a routine.
So he never shit on the white person.
We did a routine where I was reading Life magazine and he was reading Ebony, which at the time were the same size. And I would read the white version of a story and he'd do the black version of the story. You know, it was fun stuff. No, I never experienced, oddly enough, any kind of racism in either direction.
Now, I'm going to ask you a personal question.
Sure, go ahead.
You're in that world.
Yes.
Obviously, the women in your life are now all black women that are around you. Are you like going out with like at that time, which was a very tough time, were you experiencing a lot of interracial relationships that were sort of taboo?
Everybody that I met and spent time with in that 2.5 years was non-white. Except when I would come home. When I came home to Rhode Island, I had friends in Rhode Island. It was really an odd existence. He would book 2 weeks at the Flamingo in Vegas, and we'd play the 2 weeks and then have 2 weeks down, and I'd go back to the furniture store. It was insane. It was crazy. You know, we'd be up all night in Vegas for 2 weeks, and then I'd go to the store at 10 o'clock in the morning. It was a bizarre time, which ended basically when he and Steve Rossi had come to see us. He had split up with Marty Allen, and he had an offer from Caesar's Palace for he and Slappy to do pretty much the same act, except with Steve singing. And Slappy offered to keep me on as a writer for the same amount of money. And I said, no, I want to try to crack Hollywood. So I came out here and moved into the Players Motel on Vine Street and decided to get a job.
All right. So you took the risk and came out here.
I did. Yes.
So how did you get the first job?
Oh, this is a good story, Barry. I'm sitting in the Players Motel on Vine Street. I gave myself 6 days to get a job. I figured if it takes longer than that, you know, it's probably not going to happen.
So wait, you came here with enough money to last you 6 days.
Yes, that's right. And a collection of jokes about the size of a phone book, because I had written jokes every day for 2.5 years.
And these were typed or written by hand?
They were typed. They were typed on an old typewriter, an old blue. I can't remember what kind it was. I later got an IBM Selectric that was stolen by this guy in Harlem named Sylvester the Pants Man. He was called Sylvester the Pants Man because he would steal. To measure. In other words, he would take your measurements and then he would go out and steal and have pants tailored that would fit you perfectly. You could also buy cars from Sylvester. He worked out of a club called the Blue Book in Harlem. Fascinating, fascinating guy. Anyway, he stole me an IBM Selectric typewriter, which I used in later years.
So you knew that he stole a typewriter, but you still bought it from him?
Yes, yes. I wrote all my material on a stolen typewriter.
I just don't picture you. I look at you in the highest esteem. And
yeah. Well, you weren't around then. I also didn't look like everybody else at that time. You know, I was influenced by black entertainers, so I wore a lot of satin. I had sunglasses that matched the color of my shirt. My hair was long at the time. You know, in the late 60s. I had hair like the Beatles. You know, and that was an unusual thing at that time.
Now, don't be mad at me for asking this. I'm going to go back to the well here.
Yeah.
So you're dating a lot of black women.
That's yes.
And did you tell your family?
No, I don't remember telling them anything about my adventures on the road. There were more things than women. You know, it was a whole new world. Like Slappy became a surrogate father to me. And he told me things that a real father would never tell me. For instance, he said, it's OK to smoke dope, but stay away from cocaine. Now, this is very good advice, but your dad is probably not going to give you this advice, right? Your real dad isn't. But Slappy did, and I took his advice, and at least for 20 years. And
you're still taking his advice?
I take it now, yes. There was a brief period there where I ignored it.
So I stopped you here. So go for the next story of how you... So you're coming here. We have a dollar and a dream, 6 days.
Yeah, and I had a bunch... And I had a phone number because Slappy had done a special called Soul, which was a black version of Laugh-In that George Schlatter produced. Mm-hmm. So I had, he gave me George Schlatter's phone number. He said, call him when you get to L.A. And
George Schlatter is one of the most iconic comedy producers of all time. And
you've got to have him in here. He's the best guy ever.
I know.
He's got the greatest stories.
And I haven't had him in here yet. And he's produced every kind of comedy. And to this day, I don't know how he does it. He still produces great things.
I love George Schlatter. He's the last of the real cougars. He's the last of the real honest-to-God producers. Anyway, I had George Schlatter's phone number. I'm making air quotes here. so we worked our last date in Dallas, and then he was going off to Vegas to be with Steve Rossi. And I came out here and booked into the Players Motel on Vine Street, which is now called something else. It's a Travelodge or something. It's near Santa Monica, behind the Pavilions.
How much money did you have on you?
Oh, I don't remember. I had less than $500 for sure, you know. So I got there on a Sunday. I got there on Sunday night. I was watching some hockey playoffs, I remember. And the next day I got up and I called George Schlatter. And it was the NBC switchboard. That's what the number was for. So I asked for George Schlatter, and I waited. And his secretary, Donna, answered. I said, George Schlatter's office. I said, hi. I introduced myself. I said, I've got this material. I'd like to talk to George. She said, he's in a meeting. He'll call you back. So I said, okay. This is the first time I had ever heard the phrase, he's in a meeting. And I believed her. I thought he was in a meeting and he would call me back. He didn't. So I sat there all day on Monday. And
because back then you didn't have a cell phone. You had the hotel phone. You had to sit by the phone.
Yeah, you were tethered to the phone. I had to stay by the phone. He never called back. So I thought, that's weird. You know, so Tuesday morning, I call him again, you know, and got Donna again. And she said, yeah, he got the message, but, you know, he'll call you back. He's in a meeting. So I said, okay, all right. So I hung up and now I'm thinking, this guy's not going to call me back. So we had done the Steve Allen show, Slappy and I, and two guys who ran it were Jeff Harris and Bernie Kukoff. And Jeff had said to me when we did the show, did you write these jokes? And I said, yeah. He said, well, if you're ever looking for a job, give me a call. So I called the Steve Allen show. And switchboard answered. I said, Jeff Harris and Bernie Kukoff. They said, they're not here anymore. They've been fired. So I said, oh. I said, well, who's running the show now? And they said, Elias Davis and David Pollack. So I said, well, can I talk to them? And they said, let me put you through their office. They were in a meeting. They'd call me back. They never did. But they gave me a number for Jeff Harris and Bernie Kukoff. So I called the number, and Bernie Kukoff answers the phone because his secretary, Tina, was in the bathroom. This is a pivotal point in my life.
Fate is such a strange
thing. If Tina doesn't go to the bathroom at that exact moment, I'm working in a furniture store today. Maybe.
Fate is a very strange thing. So whenever you're in a relationship and your girlfriend has to pee, think of it as a good moment.
So Bernie answers the phone and he says, yeah, what do you want? I said, well, I went through the whole spiel again. He said, how old are you? I said, what was I, 23 at the time? And he said, you know, we're prepping a show for Jimmy Durante and we're looking for a new writer. So I said, well, I'm about as new as they come. So he said, you have any material? So I said, yeah. He said, bring it over. And they were on Sunset Boulevard. There were two buildings over by Tower Records that had elevators that were outside the building. I don't know if they're still there. Anyway, that's where they were. So I went out on the street. I got my material and waited for a taxi. And that's how I figured you flagged down a taxi, right? I was New York based. So I stood there quite a while. And the manager of the hotel is watching me. And he came out and he said, do you want a taxi? So I said, yeah. He said, all right, I'll call one for you. So anyway, they called a taxi. I went up there and I walked in and Tina was there. And they brought me into the office. Jeff and Bernie had partners' desks. And And I had this pile of material like this, but I was odd looking. As I said, I was wearing a purple satin shirt and purple sunglasses and big boots, and I was very strange. So they said, "All right, drop off your material. We'll read it. We're going to London tomorrow." This is also a lie. "We're going to London tomorrow, so we'll get back to you after a while." See, if they said they're going to London, there was no real pressure to call you back, and they could, push you aside. So I go back to the hotel, and I walk in, and the phone rings, and it's Kukoff. He's looked at the material, and he saw that I could write jokes. So he said, "How long did it take you to write these?" I said, "Well, it's a product of 2.5 years. So he said, "Can you write something for me?" So I said, "Yeah, what do you want?" He said, "A monologue for Bob Hope, 2 pages. Crosstalk between Jimmy Durante and Bob Hope, 2 pages. And crosstalk between Jimmy Durante and the Lennon Sisters, 2 pages. So I said, "Sure, yeah, I can do that." So he said, "When can you have it?" I said, "I'll have it tomorrow morning." So he said, "Okay, you sure?" I said, "Well, yeah, this is kind of what I do. Yeah, I can do that." So I went out and bought a bunch of newspapers and wrote topical jokes. I wish I still had these. And I stayed up all night. I wrote the jokes. This is now Tuesday night. Wednesday morning, I get up. I'm looking at the material. I'm thinking, "This, I don't know if it's good enough. It seems funny to me. I don't know." And I'm walking out the door, and the phone rings, and it's George Schlatter. George Schlatter called me back on Wednesday. So I made an appointment to go see him later on that afternoon, and I go and drop off the material to Jeff and Bernie. Then I go to Burbank, and I meet with George. He was in an office building that was directly across from the smokehouse. It doesn't exist anymore. They knocked the building down. And I met with George. I dropped the material off, and that was a great meeting. I mean, he was just so full of energy, just an amazing guy. But I never heard from him. I heard from him a year later when Durante's show got canceled. He hired me to work on Laugh-In. But I go back to the hotel, and Bernie Kukoff is called, and he said, "We want to hire you. We want to put you on staff." So we said, "We'll have our agent call you." William Morris was packaging the thing. It was a guy named Fred Apollo called me. And they offered me, they said, I can't pay you scale, which was $600 a show. We can't afford that, but we'll give you $400 a show, but we can't give you credit. Because if you're going to get credit, you have to get scale. So I thought, the only reason I'm doing this is to get credit. This is a chance. So I called Slappy and I said, "What should I do?" So he said, "Tell him you want $600 and you want credit." So I did. And they kept me hanging till Friday, and they called back and said, "Okay, you have a deal."
I'm surprised you didn't say, "Listen, I just got back from meeting with George Schlatter."
I wish I'd been smart enough. See, I needed a manager. That's what I needed.
I'm always there for you, Doug.
I didn't have one. So they called back on Friday and said, "Okay, we start on the first week of June, and we'll see you there." So I went back to Rhode Island, packed up everything, rented a house in Northridge, I think, and came out here and went to work on this series. There were two other writers. There was a guy named Bill Box, who had invented the box cards, the first greeting cards that had jokes, and a guy named Hugh Wedlock Jr., who was 72 years old and had added the junior to his name so people would think he was his own son. Because ageism did exist even then. And Huey, he was a great guy. He had worked for Jack Benny for years and years and years. And he had all these great stories, and he was kind of a cynical guy. He said, "Well, let me tell you what show business is, kid. They get you used to living on $1,000 a week, and then they take it away." Right. And he was right about that. He was right about a lot of things. He said, "If Milton Berle likes you, he'll show you his cock," which was also a thing that turned out to be true, because Milton was Jimmy that year had called in all his favors. So we had all the biggest stars in the world, no pun intended. Sinatra was on that show, and Danny Thomas and Bob Hope and Berle, and all kinds of people were on that series. That series had its own problems because in the middle of production, in the middle of the season, some lunatic shot and killed the father of the Lennon Sisters, some guy who thought he was married to one of the Lennon Sisters. It was a bumpy ride.
Hey, everybody. I hope you're enjoying this episode as much as I am. If you made it this far and you haven't fallen asleep yet, then you must be the type of person who's serious about having a career in the comedy business. That's why I'm offering you my blueprint for success, a one-of-a-kind all-access pass into my knowledge and experience after over 40 years of working with the best of the best in this crazy entertainment industry. I'll tell you all the stories, all the philosophies, give you all the great special guests, and even give you one-on-one private consultations to help you expand, enhance, and skyrocket your comedy career. Just go to BarryKatz.com and click on Blueprint for Success to learn more about my groundbreaking digital academy that I've created just for you. With it, we can take your career so far that one day, instead of listening to this podcast, you'll be interviewed on it.
Well, what's interesting is even back then, in the very beginning, television would take musical artists who had no comedy training and try to make them funny. And throughout time, you were involved with a bunch of those things, yes. Like the Cher special, yeah. And everything like that. Yeah. Now, thankfully, she was funny.
Cher was funny, yeah. Cher was great.
So you do that show. What's the next step in your career? What happens next?
George called, and I did 3 years on Laugh-In, where I met Alan Katz, who became my partner. We wanted to break into half hours, which was a much higher art form. You know, if you're a joke writer, you couldn't write half hours.
Can we just talk about Laugh-In for a second?
Sure.
So, again, probably one of the most groundbreaking shows at the time.
Indeed. Yeah.
Dan Rowan and Dick Martin. Okay, so they were a comedy team that worked the circuit, and they were given their own show. But when they got the show, were they known as... You know how certain comedians get shows who shall remain nameless, some of which you've worked with, who they get shows and the other comics are looking around, you know, saying, dirty, rotten world, that guy couldn't hold my jock strap. Was that comedy team, were they respected or were they just given a show ahead of a lot of other guys that were much more respected at the time?
I have no idea. I had never heard of them. I wouldn't know them. If I ran into them on the street, all I knew was I had a job and there were two guys named Dan and Dick who were the stars of this thing. I didn't know what their history was. I didn't know where they stood in relationship to other teams. I was just happy to have someplace to go.
So you go, you have your cast there of all these unique individuals, Joanne Worley, Ruth Buzzi, yeah. Henry Gibson.
Henry Gibson. Yeah.
Goldie Hawn.
Yeah. And then later, Lily Tomlin.
Now, when you were there and you step on the set and you just meet these people the first time, or maybe you see the first show before it airs, who was it of all those people that in your mind you thought was going to be the biggest star?
Oh, it's definitely Lily. You know, I thought Lily was, and I still think, a genius. She joined the show. The show was the number one show in the country when I joined it. It was already a hit. It was in its, I think it was the third year, and I stayed another 3 years. George, in fact, left, and the show was taken over by a guy named Paul Keyes. But Lily was, you know, I thought Lily was the best thing to ever come down the road. And I think I was right, you know. And Goldie was one of those people who was lit up from inside. You know, she just had that light around her. She was clearly special.
Got it. Interesting. And so keep going. So now you're telling me how that.
Yeah, well, I got to with all the writers. The writers were housed in a motel. Very few people know this. It was called the Toluca Capri. It's still there. It's across diagonally across the street from Warner Brothers. And we had all the apartments in that hotel, I guess it's
so
a motel.
So it was a working and living house. Situation.
Well, we didn't live there. There was a woman who did live there. We're never really sure what she did, but who wasn't part of our group. But the rest of the Laugh-In writers were housed in the Toluca Capri.
And do you know, as you're going into the next gig, do you know that I'm never going to do another job at the furniture store again? It's like, what was the moment that happened where you said, I'm confident that I'm never going to have to go back?
Well, when I got on the Durante show, I then got an agent. You know, so I like to say my agent believed in me when everybody else did. But I got an agent, a great agent, actually, a guy named Bernie Weintraub. And he was partnered with a guy named Stu Robinson, and they had their own agency. They had both been in the big agencies, and they started this little boutique agency. And I knew once I signed with them that I was never going back to the furniture store. There's no way I'm staying here, no matter what happens. But you know, this business, this life of ours is like living on the side of a volcano constantly. You never know when it's going to blow up. You never know. And I mean that in both ways. You blow up and become very successful, or you blow up and you're lying on the side of the road in pieces. You know, if you're looking for security, this is the wrong place to be.
Well, you know, I say something, and maybe I say this too much, but there's many other professions that are much more difficult than this. Obviously, if you're going to become any kind of doctor that's doing surgery, as I like to say, you f*** up one time and you can't work anywhere in the country. If you're a writer and you f*** up one time, that's called a day. And then it's rewritten and you make it work. So I think that writers and people in this business, I think it's a much better situation than people give it credit for, because as a writer, yes, it is tough because, you know, you write something and then maybe somebody says, we don't like that, but then you just rewrite it and you have a chance to do it again. No, very rarely do you hand something in and somebody says, you're fired. They give you a chance to correct your work. But I want to keep going here. So you go from the Laugh-In. What's the next show?
Well, during Laugh-In, I started writing half hours with Alan Katz. I met this guy, Alan Katz, from Chicago, who George had hired because Alan had written a funny box. There was a product called Screaming Yellow Zonkers. And Alan worked for an advertising agency in Chicago and had written the box. And George picked up a box in Marina Del Rey in the supermarket and tracked him down and hired him. He's one of the funniest people I've ever met to this day. Alan is great. And we became partners and we wanted to break into half hours. And Bernie said, there's no way, you're a joke writer. You can't do half hours. You know, that's you have to be more sophisticated.
So your great agent said, Don, you can't.
You can't do that. You're going to be a variety show writer. Variety shows are never going to die. You're going to keep doing this forever.
What do you do when your agent says, Don, you can't do that?
I called Red Fox, because Red Fox was a friend of mine from the road. We had gotten high together. You know, he and Slappy started out as a team. They were called Lewis and White in St. Louis when they were both young. And I had hung out with Red a lot of times when we were on the road, and I knew him real well. He was the funniest person in the world to me.
And his comedy was very, very blue.
But it was also conceptual. You know, my wife weighs 350 pounds. She thinks I love her because when I get in bed, I roll toward her. That's a great joke. You know, that's a great joke, as well as the dirty ones. She said, kiss me where it smells, so I drove her to El Segundo. But seriously. So Red had just gotten this show called Sanford and Son, which was a gigantic hit based on an English show called Steptoe and Son. And the English show had 12 scripts that that a guy named Aaron Rubin, who produced that show, he reworked those 12. And now they got the back nine and they don't have any scripts. So I called Red and I said, you know, can you get us in there? And he said, sure, absolutely. Because Red wasn't fond of white people except for me and a couple of other folks over the years. So he liked the idea that I was going to, you know, come in there and help. And Alan and I wrote, I think we wrote 7 Sanford and Sons that year while we were working on Laugh-In. We also wrote a pilot, our first pilot for Aaron Spelling. It was called Mrs. Thursday. We wrote it for Pearl Bailey. That was about a cleaning woman who talks to the guy who runs the conglomerate, and he dies and leaves her the conglomerate. We never became a series, but that was our first time writing a pilot. And during that time, we wrote episodes. In those days, you freelanced. We wrote an episode of All in the Family, and I forget what else, bunch of other stuff. So Alan and I started a career that lasted, we were together for 3 years, I think, and we did all kinds of things. We did the Gleason Show together. Yeah, I could talk about the Gleason Show for 3 hours, which was a one-hour special.
Well, I think one of the things I want you to talk about with Gleason is that, first of all, for those in the audience, you're listening, you got a guy like Don, and he's telling you about all these pilots he wrote that didn't go anywhere.
That's right.
And that's what writing is. You know, you just keep going. You just keep putting it out there, and the timing is right, and you never know that day when the person goes to the bathroom. But anyway, but going for this, because this story, I want to talk about working with talent, because you work with all kinds of talent.
I have.
And a lot of times what you don't know in the audience when you're watching a show, you don't know what they're like behind the scenes. Nobody knows. So if I were to mention anybody right now, I were to mention Ray Romano, Ellen, Jackie Gleason, I bet most of you in the audience would think, God, they seem like nice people.
Uh-huh.
All of them are great to work with. I'm not going to comment on any of them and how great they are to work with, because they've always been great to me, although I never knew Gleason. But you'll find different conversations around what it was like working with certain people, what it was like working for Jay Leno, Dennis Miller, David Letterman, Jimmy Kimmel, Johnny Carson. Everybody has different stories, but when you see them on television, huggable and lovable, and you don't know. Now, with Gleason, when I watched, all I saw was a guy who I thought was huggable, lovable, and a genius. But you and the writers saw a different side of him. Could you talk about that?
Well, yeah. First of all, I agree with you. I watched him under very unique circumstances, which I'll get to at the end of this story. Alan and I were a really hot team at this time. This is around 1972, 73. And two guys named Frank Pepiot and John Aylesworth had been hired to go down and do the Gleason Show. They've been hired by a producer named Bob Finkel. Frank and John had created Hee Haw, which was a country version of Laugh-In. It had been canceled by CBS while it was in the top 10 because they wanted to change their viewer profile. And Frank and John mortgaged their houses, risked everything, and went station to station and syndicated that show by themselves, ended up with more stations than CBS had, and became really, really rich. So that's where our starting point is. They were also, Frank Pepiot was one of the most elegant drunks I've ever met in my life. He was just the classiest guy, but he always had a martini in his hand. And he was always kind of very much like Peter Lawford. He was like an English lord. I loved Frank Pepiot and also John. So anyway, they called us and said, you know, would you come and talk to us about working for Gleason? So we go out to Malibu. Frank was renting a house in the Colony. And we knock on the door, and Frank opens the door. He's got a martini. He says, ah, Cats in Rio, yes. Do you drink? So I said, yeah, occasionally. He said, good, good. Come in. Come in. Let's drink and talk. And his thing was, you know, we get to wear this T-shirt. We worked with Jackie Gleason. You know, we're going to write an episode of The Honeymooners. This is it's an opportunity you can't pass up. So we made a deal. We go to Florida, and Gleason at the time was in a place called Inverary, which is, it's slightly past hell, about two off ramps past hell.
Now, you know, when you're working with a big star, when a show has to come to him.
Yes. Oh, yeah. The show took place in this development that he was part of called Inverary. And at the time, it might be very nice now, but at the time it was brand new and it was way away from the ocean. And it was August in Miami. So it's not good. So we get there the first day. We're meeting at the tennis club and Gleason is sitting. There was a lake there and a man-made lake. And Gleason is sitting with his back to the lake in the shade. And he has chairs all set up in the sun for all of us to sit. And he sits down and says, OK, here's what we're going to do. And he runs through the whole show. And then he comes over and shakes hands, introduces himself to me and to Alan. And I thought, this is nice. OK, we had to sit in the sun, but it's all right. So we go back to the condo. We were the only people in this entire development because it, you know, it was not livable. It was not fit for human beings in August. So we go back there, and his producer was a guy named Jack Philbin. And Jack Philbin comes in. He's laughing. He said, you know, Jackie thought that you guys, Alan and I, were Pepe at Nailsworth's agents. Otherwise, he would have never talked to you. And in fact, Jackie didn't talk to anyone except a writer named Walter Stone, who worked for him for years. Walter was also a great guy. But Jackie, if I asked you a question, you're Jackie Gleason, you would answer Walter. You wouldn't talk to me directly. He was difficult. He would sneak around in the afternoons and peek in the window. This is one of the biggest stars in the world. And he would peek in the windows to see if we were working at 3 in the afternoon. Frank and John were rich and they'd fly to LA every weekend, right? They'd come back, but Al and I were stuck in the Everglades for 6 weeks. Anyway, cut to the night of the show. We write the show, the whole show, the Honeymooners and the Reggie Van Gleason in a week, because he had the story all laid out what he wanted. It was not difficult. So he said, work on the monologue. So we worked on the monologue for 5 weeks. We wrote jokes every single day. They were never good enough. Never enough to say, okay, take some time off. So 5 weeks of writing jokes. And we go down. There's a big production meeting. All the stars are there. And we move to Miami. Frank and John moved us to Miami, not the show. Frank and John got us hotel rooms at the Doral Hotel. And it's the night of the show. And it's raining hammers and nails. It's raining the way it can only rain in the tropics. It is unbelievably pouring down rain. We have one car. Frank's driving. Frank's a little tipsy. It's early, though. John is sitting in the passenger seat, and Alan and I are in the back seat. It was some kind of Ford or something. Anyway, we pull up to the Miami Beach Auditorium, and we go around the side, and there's a guy standing there. I remember he's wearing a yellow slicker with a, you know, kind of a policeman's hat and a long yellow slicker, and he's got a list. So we pull up, and Frank rolls down the window, and he says, "Hi, we're the writers." And the guy said, "What are your names?" And Frank gives him our name, and the guy says, "You're not on the list." And Frank turned around, he looked at me, he said, "We're not on the list." So he said, "What do you suggest we do?" The guy said, "Well, there's a parking lot 2 blocks down. There's some spaces on the third floor. You park there, and then you walk back." Frank says, Oh, great. Thank you very much." And he rolls up the window and he turns around. Now, in front of the Miami Beach Auditorium, there was a circle then with grass and a flagpole in the middle of the circle. And Frank turns around and he decks it. And we back up, bounce over the sidewalk and slam into the flagpole. Frank opens the door and he gets out and he's standing there. He's backlit now because there's lights coming from the Miami, from the marquee. He's backlit. He stands there. He's instantly soaking wet and he says, "See ya." And he walked off into the night and I never saw him again. It was the greatest exit in the history of time. He just went away. So at some point, John gets out and follows him.
That's two people in your life that you never saw again.
John follows him. Al and I finally make our way into the Miami Beach Auditorium, where Jackie Gleason has set up a monitor and a couch for us and his agent, a guy named Sam Cohen, to watch the show in the men's room of the Miami Beach Auditorium. There's an ante room, kind of, they used to call it a smoking area, a step up here, and then a row of urinals that went, I don't know, three city blocks. And we're sitting there on this couch. People are coming in to, you know, go to the bathroom.
It's all about urine.
Well, and the monitor comes on, the show starts, right? It's freezing in there. It's 55 degrees. He always had it cold in there. And Gleason comes out and he says, now, don't forget, we've been writing monologue jokes for 5 weeks. Gleason comes out and he says, "Ladies and gentlemen, the greatest audience in the world, Miami Beach Auditorium. We got so much show tonight. We're not going to do a monologue. Here's the June Taylor dancers." Right? So after all this time, he skips the monologue and then does the rest of the show. And I sat there in the men's room after 5 weeks of dealing with this guy, and he made me laugh. He was brilliant. And that's my Gleason story.
So in your mind, I've heard this a few times by a few great writers like yourself, that I'll tell you where I heard it. And if I heard it the last time I remember from an executive producer, Robert Morton. Variety Morty. Producer. Yeah. Morty. And he said, told me about the day after 15 years of working on the number one show on television and late night, Letterman calls him in his office and says, we're going to make a change. Uh-huh. And he says he never saw Letterman again, never talked to him again. And I asked him, do you watch the show? And he says, every night. Every night he makes me laugh. So what that tells me is the great, great artists who are the geniuses, they transcend bad things that happened to you with them, and you still have to watch them.
Yeah, well, you know, there's a separation. You have to make a separation between the art and the artist. You know, it's there's an old saying that never sit too close at the ballet, because if you're up front, you can hear them grunting and farting and stuff, and it ruins the illusion, you know? So you don't want to get too close to your heroes. It's often depressing.
What comes next after Gleason?
Oh, Gleason, there was a string of variety shows, and then we got hired to work on MASH. Larry Gelbart had left, and Al and I were hired by Gene Reynolds to do MASH. So here we are.
So now you're doing single-camera dramedy. It was probably the first dramedy that I ever remember on television. Very unique concept.
Yeah, I think it was. Well, you know, it was a hit movie. We had met Alan Alda. Alan had done a limited series called We'll Get By, which was Paul Sorvino and Mitzi Hoag. And Alan and I were writers on that show. Alan had based the show really on his life. And we knew Alan a little bit. So when this opportunity came up, when Larry Gelbart, you know, who's not replaceable, he's a gigantic genius. When he left, there was an opening there, and we got the opportunity to work on that show.
And I believe the only cast member that was on the show from the movie was Radar O'Reilly, right? Gary
Berghoff. I
think
that's right. Yeah, Gary Berghoff. Yeah.
Which is another guy who was fascinating, who was huggable and lovable on television, and behind the scenes was probably the most difficult person on the set.
I wasn't directly involved with Gary, but I remember people talking about him being, you know, the one guy who wasn't as easy to get along with as everybody else in that group. I never experienced it, but. And I wasn't there when McLean Stevenson was there, who apparently was also somewhat difficult for Larry.
Who left when it was a hit show. And, you know, people always talk about stars that leave shows like McLean Stevenson and Shelley Long, I believe, on Cheers. And if they make the right decisions. And what's odd is when you look at certain situations like that, I don't know of one example where somebody left a hit show early on where it suited them and things went well.
I can't think of one off the top of my head either. But that, you know, when McLean left, there was a full episode that was written about him leaving. And then Larry wrote another scene. And the scene where Radar comes out and says he's dead, his plane went down.
I remember that.
Nobody on the stage knew about that, you know, and Larry did it at the last minute to really cut off any possibility of McLean coming back.
That was a moment I'll never forget on television.
Yeah.
As always, this has been Industry Standard with me, Barry Katz. And if you like the show, tell all your friends. And if you don't like the show, tell all your friends.
You get all the money, drive that fancy car, all the people. People love you, 'cause you're going far. Life is for the dreamers, they have all to gain. It's never quite over till it all feels the same. You pick your own poison. Down in the valley.
Thank you for listening to Industry Standard with Barry Katz. If you'd like more info on our schedule of new episodes or how to reach Barry through Twitter, Facebook, or email, go to BarryKatz.com. Before you leave, please take a moment to subscribe to our podcast, leave a comment, and rate it, even if you think it blows. Thank you for your support, and have a great day.
Hey, everybody. Let me remind you one more time about my new blueprint for success. It's a project I've spent months and months working on just to help you jumpstart your comedy career and beat the competition. Whether you want to do stand-up, sketch, improv, acting, writing, producing, directing, radio, social media influencing, or even if you want a career behind the scenes as a manager or agent, Blueprint for Success will give you all the tools you need to take your career to the highest levels. With exclusive interviews, my top 50 commercial-free episodes from Industry Standard, one-on-one coaching with me, and unprecedented access into my knowledge and experience from over 40 years in this crazy business, I guarantee you that with Blueprint for Success, you'll become the creator you've always dreamed of becoming. No one's asking me to do this. I want to do it because I want to help you become truly undeniable. So just go to BarryKatz.com, click on Blueprint for Success, and start your incredible journey today. I truly can't wait to work with you to help you change the trajectory of your comedy career forever.